The Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics. Every 2 years, every 4 years, it's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. Doing a podcast about news and views is definitely difficult because over the period of 24 hours where you get a podcast together, events change across the planet. Everything's moving very, very quickly, and this is what I would expect right here on the calendar as we come into 2012. And the events you see happening are nothing compared to what you're going to see. Everything is just picking up speed. But in this particular podcast, in the first part, I go over several different news events prior to Libya. The second part, I go over news events in regards to Libya and some interesting developments between the top of America, that's Taliban and Hillary and whoever's behind them, and Sarkozy, London, which you're getting into Pink Rabbit Bankster territory, right? You might as well be speaking for Israel as well. And between them and Germany and Russia. Germany and Russia are not into this action. Russia, of course, Putin's playing his game. He's condemning it hard, right and left, center. He's condemning it more and more every day. Usually when he condemns any type of military action, it means they prepare to counter it on some level. If they want chaos in the Middle East, you know, they're prepared to deliver a lot of chaos. Now, in my opinion, Sarkozy has problems with an election coming up. Le Pen's daughter, Marine Le Pen, is giving him heat. She polled only 2% under him, 15 to 17%, and she could probably take the presidency. Sarkozy has led the action in Libya, and he is he's Team Pink Rabbit all the way. Bankster lines, not elitist, he's not related to European royalty. He may very well have got the ball started on World War III, has got the ball rolling. The fur is definitely starting to fly in Libya. People are dying. There's a no-fly zone. Israel wants to expand that no-fly zone. Israel will probably try to play its cards by sowing more chaos. It will not go well for them. All eyes would be on Bahrain and Saudi Arabia to see what happens. Taliban and company are, of course, pushing democracy. You know, for hundreds of years, Team Jew Rabbit, Team Pink Rabbit especially has pushed democracy, equality, fraternity, and what whoever's behind Taliban is pushing it down their throats in, in their own backyard in the Middle East. You get democracy in any of these places, the first thing they're going to vote for is to attack Israel or whatever, or worse. So watching this whole relationship develop is interesting, but watch Putin, watch Sarkozy, watch Marine Le Pen, especially listen to Putin take the lead on condemning it and what he says about it. Watch, watch and see how the no-fly zone, if the no-fly zone expands, because this is all about World War III. This is all about Iran. So keep your eyes open. And in the next part, again, we're going into news pieces. Two different news sections that will be pretty interesting. I speculate and answer questions about Pink Rabbit Elitesters. Some interesting things I entertain. And in the end, I talk about a genetic, with the purest animal on the planet. Something that most of you have never heard talked about. In fact, I'm guessing the vast majority of you don't even know anything about. It's something we used to have for pets. The indigenous white rabbits of Europe used to have a famous pet that was, it is the purest animal on the planet. I'm going to talk about all these things. So we'll be back with you and we'll get the ball rolling. It's time again. It's time to hear from your favorite pre-dynastic Egyptian god. And of course, our hearts go out to all the little yellow rabbits over in East Asia, sitting under that ring of fire over there, that gigantic earthquake zone that has hit Japan. And I've been asked a lot of questions about this. A lot of the different alternative news and researchers are putting out all kinds of different things about it. And I've been asked my thoughts on it. And it's a ring of fire. It is a bunch of tectonic plates over there and all that kind of stuff, and big earthquakes can happen, have happened, and did happen. And it's horrible. It's a horrible tragedy. And I've been asked exactly, do I think weather wars are breaking out or earthquake wars? Well, that's impossible to tell. It sounds a little ridiculous to most listeners. You know, white rabbits have no idea the type of technology their race has its hands on, for good or ill. You know, pink rabbits have all kinds of stuff, and they're backed into a corner. And when they get backed into the corner, especially when you get into the leadsters and the banksters, are likely to do anything. The only patent I know of for weather control goes back to 1983 and goes back to the Hartfields. And in the Hartfield patents, Bernard Eastman makes it quite clear. One of the particular patents is for weather modifications. And since then, the Japanese have speculated that they may... if they ever reoriented their policies, reoriented things toward the east, or got away from the bankster clans or the elitesters, the Bushes, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and that type of thing, if they ever reoriented their policies, that they may use this to harm them or something like that, which sounds kind of outrageous. You know, America would never do that. But you're kind of dealing with speculation on where this type of weapon system or where this type of weather modification would be. And I can only point out that there's a patent for it. And of course, you got the U.S. Air Force, and I'll put up different news releases going back all the way into the 90s. Weather as a force multiplier, owning the weather in 2025, military applications of weather modification. This is U.S. Air Force, and this is under their jurisdiction. It's under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Air Force based on the new stuff that they put out. And, of course, you go into U.S. military wants to own the weather in October 31st, 2005. This type of thing is highly speculative on would they, and the Asians, a lot of Asians believe that that's what's happened because the Emperor of Japan has reoriented Japanese policy. You have him lining up with certain elements in China, and we've talked about this before, certain elements in Korea, and most importantly, Taiwan. Taiwan's the center of a lot of right-wing activity these days. I would have been surprised if they didn't hit Taiwan with an earthquake or something as revenge for certain acts. But who knows? It's very speculative. They are on a ring of fire. They've had horrible earthquakes before, and they've had horrible earthquakes again. But let me put these emails to rest. Do I think they would do it? Well, early in the 20th century, World War II. Halfway through the 20th century, you had World War II. And in World War II, there was an experimental type of technology called nuclear technology, and you have nuclear weapons. And would they drop a nuclear weapon on Japan? Sure. Would they firebomb Dresden? Sure. It's the same crew. this is the same crew. Do that. They've done it. They've done that type of thing. And by the way, the firebombing of Dresden killed more people than Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the question is, would they use a weather weapon? If the trend is in place that they're developing weather manipulation, how difficult would it be to take that for earthquake, to do an earthquake? Well, it's similar, except instead of in the air, you'd point it down at the earth and develop a template for that. We went down that road before. It always starts with a template of action for that particular region or area. You know, you're dealing with two or more electromagnetic waves which come together to create a lattice work and interference pattern. So if you have an interference pattern for anything, you're in business, and you don't have to, you're not dealing with linear technology, you're dealing with, you know, we're used to things where you point a weapon at something and hit it. This is a little bit different. You're dealing with concept of action at a distance and all that other kind of interesting stuff, which is an interesting word. As long as you have the rays set up, you can do this type of thing. You know, last summer I was sitting at a lake house, and I have all these pictures of the, you know, I'm not someone that looks up the sky and sees strange stuff. But the strangest sky developed a couple of evenings in a row where we had double rainbows, the sky was completely red, and the weirdest looking clouds I've ever seen in my life. And I'm a skeptic. It was so weird, we took a bunch of pictures of it. Crazy looking stuff. And I'm sure many of my listeners, no matter how skeptic or matter how new agey, have seen this type of thing in America. And that, in my opinion, goes to Hartfield. If you have the U.S. Air Force kicking out these things in 2005, that's because they're already doing it. If they're kicking out, we're going to own, completely dominate the weather by 2025, it's because they're already doing it. In the Olympic Games, the Chinese were firing primitive stuff up in the air to control the weather, and a lot of people got on their back. And they let them have it. They let them have it because Western countries, according to them, the Russians and the U.S., and the Germans can control weather. You know, that's what they were saying. You know, Yankee, go home. Don't give us this nonsense. You know, you have patents for this stuff. We don't. And the Russians, of course, have been accused of massive weather manipulation. They're supposedly at the forefront of having this type of control. But it wouldn't be, you know, if you read about Hartfield, you start talking about dealing with the ionosphere and all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, that's what you're going to be dealing with. But, you know, we're not used to something that's so diverse as far as that can be used for good or ill. We're not used for something that could be used for the Hartfields. You know, you got a patent for missile defense and weather modification. What the hell is that about? It's pretty strange stuff. But to answer shortly, there's no way for me to tell one way or another. You're dealing with a case of someone having a neutron bomb potentially and being able to drop it, but we don't know. We don't know. We don't know if that hurricane's real or if they can create one. It's highly speculative stuff. All the non-white leaders on this planet know we have it. You know, Russia supposedly has been on contract with two or three different Southeast Asia countries to affect their growing cycle. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But, Russia has had this technology for a long, long time. They needed more rainfall or something like that. So they contracted the Russians move over some rain clouds. Sounds ridiculous. Sounds fantasy. It sounds like fantasy type stuff, but you really have to look at the patents for the Hartfield. You really have to look at the trend in technology. And it's kind of like, you know, someone having a stealth bomber or having a nuclear warhead and they may be dropping it. They may be overhead manipulating stuff, but unless they're willing to come out and tell us, it becomes somewhat speculative. Other than to say that they have a patent for it, it's in the patent for a Hartfield, and if it's in the patent for the U.S. Hartfield over in Alaska, well, then guess what? The Germans are going to have it, the Russians are going to have it, anyone else with a Hartfield are going to be developing it or going that direction. It's just a question of would they do something that evil? And the question is answered, you know, if they want to get back at them for something, sure, but we won't know anything. I would assume that if they were going to do something like that and start a weather war, that they would probably do something in Iran first. That's my opinion, but I could be wrong. I have no idea. There are several different elements, especially among the more Jewish elites, especially among the Pink Rabbit Banksters that really hate Japan these days. And of course the elitesters will go along with them or vice versa. For all I know, the Queen of England may hate the Emperor of Japan for some reason or another. Who knows? I don't know. But, you know, it's highly speculative, but it's the type of speculation going around. There are patents for it. There's the U.S. Air Force now post the stuff that they're going to own the weather. They probably already do to some extent. I've seen some strange clouds. Everyone has. Everyone's seen strange stuff. Oh, it's chemtrails. It's HAARP. It's HAARP, quite simply. These guys are starting to manipulate stuff to no end. Now, whether they would do something that evil. You're dealing with basically the same group that dropped a neutron bomb on, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. You're dealing with the same people that firebombed Dresden. I've told you before, they're not going to go out in tribunals. Oh, they got some cards to play. And you're dealing with a type of technology very nuclear-like in so much as one person or a couple of different people could actually spring that, could actually put that into action. Kind of terrifying. And you don't have to be in any particular spot on the globe. You don't have to send stealth bombers to drop a bomb. You don't have to send a planes. You know, you just need HAARP fields. You need a specific array set up. And you're dealing with the concept of action at a distance. You don't have to be somewhere on the globe to affect somewhere else necessarily. Fascinating stuff, but quite dangerous. So I don't know. But Japan is on a huge, huge earthquake zone, the Ring of Fire. And they keep getting earthquakes, and it looks like a nuclear disaster. How much it ends up being a nuclear disaster is speculative, too. Some people say it's going to be a big disaster. Others say it's going to die down, and they'll get it under control. I hope for the best. I hope for the best. But Japan has reoriented its policies, and Japan has ticked off a lot of people. The Germans said something quite interesting. They offered to help the Japanese government and the Japanese people. They gave their condolences, all the European countries, a handful of European countries. Russia gave its condolences to the, and is sending, and are sending an aid. All these places are sending an aid to the Japanese government, the Japanese people. Obama just offered aid to the Japanese people, not the government. Obama didn't offer anything to the government. He never even spoke to the government. He made his public statement to the Japanese people. Interesting. Interesting difference. But these sides are getting into it right now, and Japan, of course, has been screwed over by the banksters post-World War II. They moved in there with their fraternities and whatnot. And that's just the way it goes. But it's speculative until after the fact, until someone tells us. You know, we would be in the beginnings of a nuclear war without nuclear bombs. And could someone retaliate against California or against New York or against the Madrid fault line? That's what they're speculating. We'll know if it happens, won't we? We'll also know there's another dead giveaway. You're in the end game. So in the end game, if someone pops up and this ends up being a problem which got a reaction, you know, all this scare over nuclear stuff, and someone provides a solution against nuclear technology, some new solution against for our energy needs. And again, we're going into this conflict and scarcity. We've been all through this about their particular end game. You know, white rabbits eat too much food, you use too much electricity, use too much energy, this energy, nuclear energy, is dangerous. And of course you have a huge disaster which gets a big reaction. If someone comes up on the scene with a big solution that goes against, that kind of blows your mind in regards to our next generation energy, well then you'll probably get some idea that this was, another event in the end game. And that would be a tip off, I guess. And if they're going to go this route. Obviously, it's a dangerous route. It's like lobbing neutron bombs back and forth, except we don't really know about it. We just think it's a huge disaster. But the trend is there for weather control. The patents are there, and if you can control the weather, you can certainly do an earthquake. Earthquake wouldn't be that sophisticated in comparison. And most people tell me, I mean, if you have the template for it, you're in business. So I don't know what to tell you other than that it's speculation. They're sitting on a huge fault line there, and it's obviously a horrible disaster. But let's move along for some news events. So anyone in Japan, any listeners in Japan, get yourself to safety, and hopefully everything will turn out for the better, eventually. Let's move along now through some other news events. As the war starts heating up, as World War III starts rolling to a start, North Korea nears completion of electromagnetic pulse bomb. This is ABC New World News. How interesting. Imagine that going off over East Asia or over anywhere near our a big electromagnetic pulse bomb over the eastern East Asia theater could potentially knock out all kinds of different naval assets U.S. has over there, depending on how it's done. Interesting. Mass production of fifth generation fighter jets in China unlikely. Many of you in America, they constantly do this in America. They scare us to death. They constantly use the media to shape perceptions to induce a consensus trance. I've talked about this indefinitely, but I'm going to use one example right in front of everyone's face. Everyone knows about Chinese stole a bunch of fifth generation stealth bomber technology, you know, stealth fighter technology. The Chinese are going to have them a stealth fighter. Chinese got them a stealth fighter. The Chinese, you know, on the second day of the visit, U.S. Secretary Robert Gates, the Chinese are fooling with a stealth fighter. And the Chinese have this, and the Chinese are going to get us, the Chinese are going to get us. They're going, talking about it in Congress, and all this BS. Well, the Russians put out a piece, their analysis. Now, Russia, of course, would have as much danger from the Chinese as anyone else, but this is the Russian analysis. And quote, mass production of fifth-generation fighter jets in China unlikely. And I'll redo exactly what they say. Both American and Russian fifth-gen aircrafts are indigenous or largely indigenous, he said. As for the Chinese, we are sure that many subsystems are taken from Russia and from some other countries, both legally and illegally. That is why this aircraft is not largely indigenous. And even if they would be successful to test it, it would be difficult to launch a mass production because you can steal, buy, procure for a single prototype or for a couple prototypes, but it would be difficult to do that for mass serial production. Direct opposite of what we're hearing in America. And this is according from the director of the Center of Analysis for Strategies and Technologies, Ruslan Pukhov. Despite all the noise surrounding the test flight, mass production of fifth generation fighter jets in China is unlikely. Now I want you to read this piece and then compare it to all the garbage we heard in America. Fear of China, fear of China. China is going to get you. China has a test fighter. China is going to come get us. China stealing all this stuff from us. China, China, fear of China. Yeah, don't buy into their nonsense. They do this stuff in Anglosphere non-stop. Non-stop. That's how they control us. They constantly shape perceptions, and it's always around fear. Fear, 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 fear. Seriously, if you're using fear to control people, there's actually a phrase for it, too. It's called black magic. But we won't go into that. Yeah, but this is the game they play. And obviously, if this is the Russian analysis, this should have been the American analysis as well. We've talked about this stuff incessantly, but they constantly, oh my goodness, all the conservatives, all these people buy into this stuff. There's no rational analysis anymore in the Anglo-American media. There's exoteric analysis, the analysis right in front of our face, analysis on CNN, exo being exoteric, right in front of our face, that everyone can get to that is totally there to do nothing but keep people in some fear-based consensus trance. And then there's the esoteric analysis, you know, the stuff going on behind the scenes that only a handful of parties can see, and they, of course, are writing what the Russians write. But the Russians are not there to terrify their population indefinitely of the Chinese. It's kind of counterproductive. You got to be somewhat rational with your analysis. But this is the type of stuff that... this is the type of stuff that they do this, and believe it or not, conservatives, paleo-conservatives, liberals, all different sides buy in this. White nationalists always buy into this. On one end, they'll look at the enemy's media, and they'll know they're lying. They lie about black crime. They lie about this. But what you don't know is they lie about everything. They lie about everything. There's two sources of news. There's a source that we get, and there's the sources that they actually use to read stuff. They're constantly looking to shape perception because you can control people indefinitely. If you scare people to death, if you have people suspended in a consensus trance, and they are the masters at creating it post-World War II with the news, if you have a group suspended in a fear-based consensus trance, you can control them indefinitely. Indefinitely. And I am always leery of different groups that put out nothing. It's one thing to put out a lot of crime statistics and everything else against white rabbits because it's accurate. But I'm always leery about someone that only talks about that, that never talks about anything positive you can do about it. Talking about something just actually goes to create more fear about it. And sooner or later, you have to move from reporting the news to getting a strategy together to contradict that. You know, in this broadcast, I went out of my way to point to trends, healthy trends, what's really going on. You know, some people say that's not really going what it is. This is a great example of what I've been doing since the first podcast. You're not getting healthy news sources in America. That's kind of common sense. It's not anyone's fault. You go to work all day, you come home, you watch Fox News, and they scare the hell out of you. That's not healthy. That's not, especially when you're dealing with our race, which are, you know, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe really don't operate on fear all that well. We don't do all that well on fear. We're the direct opposite of that. So it becomes somewhat, well, it's a sign of the times, isn't it? But this is a great example of us getting fed a lot of malarkey. Us getting fed a whole lot of malarkey. Now, can they eventually produce this? Sure. Sure, but the Russians, of course, announced second Sukhoi, fifth generation prototype to take wing soon. They're going to go into production. If they don't already have a handful of these out there cruising around the globe, maybe even more than that. The Russians, of course, are increasing military spending like no one else on this planet. Interesting. But this is a constant thing that you struggle with when dealing with even your average Bob Whitaker. Everyone sees it when dealing with conservatives or anyone. Anyone in America at the street level, it's not their fault. They just come home and try to get some healthy news, and then of course you have someone scaring the hell out of them. And of course, if you keep people scared, well, they won't defend themselves. You know, it's another type of demoralization. It just goes to reinforce the opposite. You got to eventually move towards some type of action, which usually starts with some type of internal change, which always starts with a consistent message in this type of system. I always tell you need a consistent message because, you know, if you go to a barber, he's going to tell you need a haircut. But this type of stuff is a classic example of what I tried to help my listeners see how this stuff works and how they use it. And they do this nonstop. I guarantee you that in Japanese, with what's going on with Japanese nuclear technology, they are going to use this, no matter what happens, to scare the hell out of America. They are going to use that to scare the hell out of America. That's their game. And it is not, it's not moral. It's not moral at all. Using fear to control people, there's no morality in it. And I've already said before exactly what it is. It is, for lack of a better phrase, black magic. Anytime you're using fear to scare or control people or shape perceptions, it's not healthy and you're engaging in something inappropriate. But there's a difference between Russia and America now, which is kind of funny because at one time the Soviet Union was kicking out all kinds of lies about the economy. Now, of course, everything's flipping upside down. The world is upside down. Let's go on to the Middle East. Ex-Goldman Sachs analyst, major war coming end of 2012. This is Alex Jones, InfoWars. Your major wars probably started already. yeah, when they come out with the piece "Major War Coming Into 2012," it's probably going to happen next month or something. You know, I've had a lot of emails saying I don't think the war is going to happen this soon, Horace. You know, it probably won't happen until this fall. It probably won't happen in 2013 or something. It'll probably happen next month. That's what I've come to believe. At any given moment, Bahrain could blow up. And of course, there's a special report out about from Stratfor, which is the Anglo elite, Jew rabbit, the pink rabbit banksters, pink rabbit elite. Leasters. This is their elite. This is how they. This is kind of their for public thinking, their exoteric type of thinking. Special report: Iran and the Saudis counter move on Bahrain. You know, there's two types of information. You know, there's a type available to only a handful, and there's type available to public. But I look at the trends in both and try to read between the lines. That's what I've done on this podcast. It's not that difficult once you get used to it. But what it says basically is in Bahrain you faced a big problem. The Iranians created a problem. That problem got a reaction. The reaction from the reaction from Pink Rabbit, Team Pink Rabbit, was to move the Saudis in there aggressively. And the Saudis moved in very, very aggressively. And now all hell's breaking loose in Bahrain. The Saudis are going to try to quell the rebellion. And what they're speculating basically is what Iran's counter move could be, because the Saudis supposedly have called their bluff in Bahrain. And you can read the piece. No one knows what the Iranians are going to do. This will most likely be a flashpoint. Something's going to happen in there to start a war. But we'll go on to some other news pieces. But this is by George Friedman himself, and you can read it and get their type of thinking. You can't allow Bahrain, because if Bahrain gets overthrown, Saudi Arabia will be next. So this is going to be a flashpoint. Now, no one thinks that, you know, Saudis have called Iranians bluff. Iran has played this stuff in the Middle East like a flute. They've played card after card after card. And the reason I think this is a flashpoint is because there comes a time when you've played all your cards and the other side gets aggressive. And the Saudis' counter move is that is extremely aggressive in Bahrain. What they're doing is extremely aggressive. And there's a reason for that. Our Fifth Fleet is stationed there. You know, you got a big fleet of American ships there, so they're going to have to do something. Team Pink Rabbit will order them in there, and you also have Obama preparing for Libya, whatever they're doing. In my opinion, the Libya stuff is a big diversion. But there becomes a time when Iran has played card after card, and it comes crunch time, and the other side knows what's going on. They know that you've been fooling around. They know that you've been preparing for this, and they're getting ready for their counter move. How this goes, how this escalates, what happens, I don't know. But the trend's toward big, 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 big war. Let's keep on with some news events. But this is an actual must-read because you'll get the type of thinking that they're kicking out night and day for you to look at. And no one knows what Iran's going to do. But my guess is Iran's going to keep on with their playbook. If you have a playbook to come into the end game and to move your pieces like they've moved them with Hezbollah, they don't move direct military assets, they move indirect military assets, or let's say, different groups of Hezbollah here and there. They're not operating so much, they're operating solely within the area of the Shia Crescent, but at the same time they're making pushes into other areas. With various different groups that they've made friends with, Hamas, Muslim Brotherhood, whatever. There comes a time when it's gonna go from being covert to overt. It comes a time when you're gonna have to play your trump cards. And what Saudi Arabia is doing is escalating things to see what the Iranians are gonna do. And I'm interested what Iranians are gonna do too. I'm guessing they have a plan for it. This is, you know, they're writing this report like Ahmadinejad is going to be so confused because he wasn't expecting the Saudis to do this. Well, anyone with half a brain is going to expect the Saudis to do that. Can't let Bahrain go down. People in Washington aren't going to allow that. So what are they going to do? They're going to get into it with Washington, you know? Is it going to be, is it time to go to war? We'll see. We'll see what Iran's playbook has next in it. But so far, they've played their cards great. Let's see here. This is an interesting piece, must read. In the Atlantic. This came out on March 4th. Could Iran be using Stuxnet to confuse the West? Interesting. After being detected by Iran, the virus may have been retooled by the country as PSYOP, psychological operations against the West. Robert Baer, the former CIA officer and author of The Devil We Know Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. The moment Iran caught Stuxnet, they could easily have put out misinformation to the effect that their nuclear program had been set back several years, simply to alleviate meetings in Western capitals so that everyone will say, all right, Stuxnet worked. Fascinating stuff. The IAEA inspectors, this is from a Charles Dilfer on Iran's program. The IAEA inspectors report that Iran continues to expand its activities and in particular its uranium enrichment. Seems to be continuing with plans for expansion. Tehran has not complied with requirements to explain suspected military nuclear work and seems unfazed by the Security Council sanctions. Moreover, the IAEA reports that the output of the declared facilities continues despite the effects of the Stuxnet cyber attacks. The evidence is that despite the increased sanction, the effects of the cyber attacks and reportedly the sabotaging of imported equipment and the assassination in Iran of top scientists, the program marches on to the point where it is beginning to look inevitable rather than unacceptable as the previous White House statements have declared. Interesting. Bibi Netanyahu's people are making noises that he's going to offer some sort of plan to restart the peace talks with the Palestinians. That he's going to announce certain concessions, that he's willing to make concessions. I have to see that to believe it. But the stuff you're hearing about Stuxnet, not only did they know about it ahead of time, but different parties involved believe that doesn't make any sense on why the thing wasn't shut down. I mean, Stuxnet should have shut down the whole entire Iranian project. That their production, everything else is going full steam ahead in spite of whatever setbacks that people think they have. So something doesn't give here. I've talked about this before. And now they believe that they retooled the thing and they're using it as psychological operations against the West. fascinating stuff. But that's the type of plays Iran has been making. They've been making brilliant plays into this stuff, almost like they have the enemy's playbook ahead of time. Let's see here. Iran continues its drive to enrich uranium, Defense Agency's chief says. I don't think he's BSing. I think either they've got whatever they need, or they're on the eve of getting it. And I think Iran is going to be something to contend with. That may be it's going to be the wall that the pink rabbit banksters, elitesters, that the red hippopotamus has to go through. Should be interesting. Let's see here. Global research preparing for Operation Libya. The Pentagon is repositioning its naval and air forces. Yeah, Operation Libya is a cover-up. Yeah, they're getting ready for war on some front, and they're getting ready for a big escalation across the Middle East. This is a funny piece. All's quiet on the Israel-Lebanon front. The volatile frontier separating the nations has been unusually calm since the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. Experts say both sides are fearful that the price of the next conflict will be too high to bear. Reporting from Jerusalem, something unusual is happening along Israel's border with Lebanon. Nothing. The 49-mile stretch, one of the Mideast's most volatile areas, it's one of the most volatile areas in the world, has been uncommonly quiet since the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. Even as both sides continue to build up arms and make war plans, it's been one of the longest lulls in fighting since Israel's founding. Look out. Yes. The calm before the storm. U.S. threatens Syria with isolations. They're making all kinds of threats across the Middle East. Let's see here. Chechen rebels urges total war with Russia. The Chechnyas, the whole entire, the Caucasus region is predicted to go up in flames, but there's two sides of that. There's a side that's pro-Russia, a side that's against Russia. We'll have to see how that goes, but in a big, big war, I would imagine it could go up. Let's see here. Saudi Arabia. Protests contradict Islamic law and are banned. Well, there you go. Just make the protests illegal under Sharia law. Ah, there you go. Protests are illegal because they contradict Islamic law. There you go. That works. Who says Islamic law isn't effective for squelling protesters? We'll see if it works, though. Let's see here. Tehran Times. Israel planning new war on neighbors. Go figure. The diplomat reiterated that since Tel Aviv is seriously worried about the consequences of the Egyptian... Oh, let's read the whole thing here. Israel is reportedly planning to launch a new war to strengthen its position in the Middle East, following recent political reforms in regional states. A Western diplomat in the Jordanian capital of Amman said on Wednesday that Israel decided to attack Syria and Lebanon following the downfall of Hosni Mubarak's regime in Egypt, which served as a great loss to Tel Aviv, the Lebanese daily Asafir reported. The diplomat reiterated that since Tel Aviv is seriously worried about the consequences of the Egyptian revolution and future developments in the region, it wants to start a new war in the Middle East in order to turn the situation back in its favor. Israel intends to overthrow Bashar al-Assad's government in Syria in a matter of weeks after a war with Lebanon's resistance movement of Hezbollah east of Lebanon near the border of Syria. Pretty wild speculation in my opinion, but you never know. Do I think they're going to start a war there? Who knows? They'll start a war somewhere. Just watch. If the fur isn't actually officially flying here. And last but not least, we have the secret space plane heading back into orbit. The U.S. Air Force has themselves a robotic space plane that keeps on going into orbit, dropping things off, and coming back to ground. Everyone's wondering, what is this thing doing? What's it launching up there? Probably satellites getting ready for something having to do with the end game, but who's to tell? Who knows? Who can tell? There's so much speculation going on, we just look at trends. And the trend, of course, is toward war. That is the trend. And again, our hearts and minds go out to the Japanese as they deal with this massive, massive earthquake. And we'll see what becomes of it. But all the speculation is just that. It's speculation. No one knows for sure. But I can point out that there are patents for the type of technology that could be used to do something like that. And you can guess as to whether or not the pink rabbit banksters or elitesters would actually do something like that. All you have to do is look at World War II. They're not nice rabbits. Not at all. And they're not going to go down without a big fight. But that's just the way it goes. And we'll continue into the next section. In the next section, I'm going to answer questions from a British National Party, guy, somewhere in the UK, or maybe it's one of their supporters in Europe. And now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever said to yourself, gee, I would love an undercover lover? Or maybe you said to yourself, gee, I would like to be an undercover lover. We know exactly how you feel. For a limited time only, on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, you can buy an undercover lover. You can be an undercover lover. Yes, for only 25 carats. It is a great investment because all the money goes to fight white rabbit genocide, which is the thing we're about here at WhiteRabbitRadio.net. So if you're looking for an undercover lover, or if you're looking to be an undercover lover, or if you're just looking to have the coolest undercover lover in the history of the undercover lovers, we have just the ticket for you, all at a very, very low price. Yeah, so hop on over there and pull up that merchandise tab. And when you see the undercover lover, you'll go wild at how beautiful it is. And hit that buy button. Support fighting white rabbit genocide in the easiest way possible. Be an undercover lover. We got all hell breaking loose across the Middle East, and I'm going to add to this update. It's very difficult to do news reports with news changing so fast. You go out to eat, or you go to the local gym, or you go grocery shopping and come back, and it's a whole new world with attacks going on in Libya and everything else. But right now, of course, there's been a bunch of speculation still about the earthquake hitting Japan, and Japan is on that ring of fire, just like everyone out west, all over Australia, New Zealand, all the way over to the west coast of the United States. It's all one big ring of fire out there, and so you never know what's going to happen. But I can give you the facts of the Hartfield and that weather controls in the actual patents going back to 1983, but that doesn't actually extrapolate into what just happened to Japan, other than they're sitting on a huge fault line and they got hammered. So we'll assume, it's speculation is what I'm saying. Some of the time the conspiracy sites don't differentiate between fact and fiction. It's what's speculation and what's legitimate. It's very difficult to figure out what our race has done defense-wise, because when you deal with an integrated technology like weather control, well, you could use it for bad, good, or ill. You could use it to affect growing seasons. You could use it to do all kinds of nasty stuff. And you're dealing with a technology that can be used in a variety of different ways all at the same time. So it's cookie cutter for a lot of speculation. I can only point out what is known, and then the rest is just a head scratcher. It's kind of like, I always compare it to the stealth bomber. You don't know what's going on until it bombs you. Then you know after the fact. That's how our green goddess operates. She's kind of sneaky with new technology. But anyways, we'll move on and we'll move across to Libya, because they just started bombing Libya. It's pretty interesting stuff. In this podcast, I talked about this war for quite some time. I got my listeners attuned to the war and all the different players. I didn't go into too much detail other than dividing up the players in the Pink Rabbit Banksters, Pink Rabbit Elitesters, and Pink Rabbits. The split between the Pink Rabbit Elitesters and the Banksters is pretty important. I'm going to go into that in a bit and answer some questions, some pretty good questions. But for right now, we have an attack on Libya, and of course, any listener of the show knows that I'm looking for war with Iran. Don't exactly know how that's going to shape up, but believe it or not, I think it's shaping up. Most listeners can agree that there's war in the Middle East right now, and it looks to be a no-fly zone, and they may go after Gaddafi, they may not go after Gaddafi. There's a lot of misinformation and confusion, believe it or not, but there's some interesting facts that have come out just recently, just in the past so many hours. And so we're going to go over some facts as we put these clues together. As we put these clues together, as we head into the opening acts of World War III, and now we got the fur flying, so it's starting. It is rolling to that violent start. How it comes about, exactly who trips it up, what events, I don't know. I look at trends, and the trend has been toward conflict in the Middle East probably for so many thousands of years, but this is just another day. This time it looks like it's going to blow up into something pretty interesting. So let's cruise around. Let's do some news events. that have happened since the first part of this podcast. The first part of this podcast, I was just going over all the news events going on. And then, of course, all hell breaks loose in Libya within the period of so many hours. Let's go. Council of Conservative Citizens. Interesting piece from RT, that's Russia Today. Gaddafi family, we secretly finance Sarkozy. When you get into Gaddafi, when you get into Sarkozy, when you get into Israel, and there's a connection between Gaddafi and Israel, in fact, you could put Gaddafi up, and you could put up a portrait of Neanderthal rabbit, and you're probably going to be right on target. There's a connection there, and they are all in cahoots and owned by Pink Rabbit Banksters. Pink Rabbit Banksters are at the top of who you think of as Judeosphere and all the different Jewish fraternities. Jewish fraternal systems, the Anti-Defamation League, and all that kind of stuff like that. You get up into bankster territory, the neocons run some of the think tanks for the bankster territories. They're on the outs with some groups because they're, you know, a lot of people are ticked off at them. They're kind of thick-headed. Neocons are very, very thick-headed. But there's all these different groups and different cabals, if you will. But by and large, you can trace it back to Rockefeller and Rothschild in that particular set. And when you get into different natural resources groups, you have some of the different Anglophile elements in there as well, and they can be kind of interesting. But by and large, when you're dealing with Gaddafi, you're dealing with Israel, and you're dealing with Rothschild. In fact, Israel wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the Rothschild family. They did a lot. They put a lot of money in it. They got a lot of money in it. And we'll have to see how this goes. But let's move on along here. But Gaddafi family, we secretly finance Sarkozy. And Sarkozy, of course, is Jewish or part Jewish. Same thing, really. Let's see here. Israel intervenes in Libya for Gaddafi. This is the Duff Salem News, Gordon Duff Salem News. I don't know. 50,000 mercenaries to be deployed against the rebels. I don't know how true this is. But it's pretty interesting. The Tel Aviv Tripoli Wiki Tango. But all these groups are combined. When you get into the House of Saud, when you get into Hosni Mubarak, they're all combined. Now, how can there be a genetic relationship? Well, We've discussed that before. And now, of course, we have Ynet News, which is Jewish news, ynetnews.com. Barak, and that's this Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak, we won't be part of Libyan intervention. I don't know what all this means. I don't know what to take it. You know, you got different groups talking nine ways to Sundays as the first starts flying in Libya. In my opinion, the no-fly zone over Libya and all the stuff in Libya is a stepping stone toward Iran. It has to be a stepping stone toward Iran. But there's been some interesting developments. So let's move on here. Reverend Farrakhan and another Council of Conservative Citizens. Reverend Farrakhan railed against Obama over Libya flip-flop. Why don't you organize a group of respected Americans? Farrakhan is a famous black rabbit over here in America. Just to let you guys know. Reverend Farrakhan. And ask for a meeting with Gaddafi. You can't order him to step down and get out. Who the hell do you think you are? That you could talk to a man that built a country over 42 years. Well, he didn't build the country, he looted the place. Be careful, brother, how you handle this situation, because it's coming to America. Yes, it is. It has already started. Look at Wisconsin. Look at Ohio. It's kind of funny. But anyways, I'll put it up to you. It's an interesting statement. I don't know if Farrakhan, it's occurred to him that Talibama answers to someone. He's got to know that. And he doesn't answer to the clique he thinks he answers to. No, he doesn't. So, I'm going to point this out to some my steady listeners. Iraq Shias. And this is the one to watch. We're watching Bahrain, and we're watching Iran. Libya's kind of a sideshow. I expect that no-fly zone to expand. Iraq Shias rally against Saudi troops in Bahrain. Interesting. Iraq Shias rally against Saudi troops in Bahrain. I want you to watch this. There's a trend taking place in the Middle East, and I'm going to point it out to you here again. Special report, Iran and the Saudis counter move on Bahrain. This is Stratfor. This is Anglophile, George Friedman, kind of neoconish, Pink Rabbit. This is Pink Rabbit Global Analysis. It's backwards, but he speaks for his group. Special report, Iran and the Saudis counter move on Bahrain. Interesting stuff. Interesting stuff about the Saudis jumping the gun into Bahrain to hold down the Shia majority, which are, of course, the Shia, the homeland of the Shia, of course, is Iran, And interesting, we get into Saudi and Bahrain. Let's keep on going, and I'll wrap this up. Saudi King orders more handouts, security boost. Saudi King Abdullah is trying to buy out everyone. Opposition leaders arrested in Bahrain as crackdown, and all these pieces can always be found on my Twitter. This is New York Times. Opposition leaders arrested in Bahrain as crackdown grows. The Saudis intervened in Bahrain because you have to avoid disaster. And as they intervened in Bahrain, there was a crackdown from above, and they arrested many of the Shia opposition leaders. Thousands in Iran, and this is an AP piece, thousands in Iran march in support of Arab revolts. Yes, interesting. What we have here is you have a move against Iran, but what's interesting, what I'm looking for is if what's happening in Libya, what looks to be happening is that they want the people to overthrow Gaddafi. That's kind of common sense. They're not bombing him directly, but they want to overthrow him. And Taliban has a coalition to do this. What the little Jew rabbits, the Jew rabbit elicers, the pink rabbit banksters and elicers post the Jacobin Revolution, what was that, the French Revolution, where the Jews went in there and Marie Antoinette lost her head, the Jacobins. If you don't know this, most of them were Jewish. But anyways, the werewolves went on a tear in there what I refer to as werewolves from time to time, and were set on a tear. Yeah, they do what the rabbis tell them to do. And so the pink rabbits had their revolution in France. And post that time, it's been democracy, democracy, democracy. Their new world order usually exists of some type of universal democracy. The problem that comes into, and they've used this, of course, against white rabbits, and white rabbits being egalitarian to some extent have joined the bill in places like South Africa to deadly consequences. But basically, right now, in my opinion, this is going to be driven down their throats. And Taliban is just taking orders, but what they're doing in Libya is driving this type of thing down their throats like they did in Egypt. Do I think Israel wanted Hosni Mubarak to go? No. Do I think Pink Rabbit Banksters in London wanted him to go? No. Do I think they wanted Zawi Hawass to step down? No. No, this is disastrous. But they're getting this democracy thing driven down their throats. What I'm interested in is if Taliban lets Bahrain fall, lets the democracy come to fruition in Bahrain, and lets democracy come to fruition in Saudi Arabia. Because not only are they going to throw out the leaders, not only are they going to vote, they're going to vote to attack Israel very, very quickly. And you have some pretty modern armies around there. And there's some groups that are playing into it big time, like Hezbollah, elements of the Muslim Brotherhood, but we'll keep our eyes on Hezbollah. But I'm looking at Bahrain and Saudi Arabia and see how this happens, because the House of Saud couldn't believe that Taliban, or whoever he's speaking for someone. He's told what to do, like none of his ancestors were slaves, but he is. He's speaking for someone, and they're basically clobbering this group indirectly by letting these democracies, so-called democracies, come to fruition. We'll call it you could call it Zionist. Yeah, it's definitely the Zionist elements are in trouble on this. But I call it Pink Rabbit Banksters, because ultimately it all results from Rothschild. Let's see here. Now this is where it gets interesting. Report, deepening rift between Germany and Israel. And I posted an interesting piece about Germany being the China of Europe. It's from Time Magazine just recently. Oh, interesting. Yeah, Germany's doing pretty well financially, believe it or not. Not every German is, but the Germans are doing well, considering they don't have a public central bank yet. They're coasting in the chaos, doing quite well in front of World War III. But report, deepening rift between Germany and Israel. Now, granted, in this report, let's read it to you. According to a report which was published this week in the New York Times, a serious rift has been opened between Germany and Israel in the last few weeks. Well, that's about time. Reports cited the recent vote in the UN Security Council over calling the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria illegal as one of the causes of the rift. The resolution was submitted by the Palestinian Authority, but did not end up passing the U.S. as the U.S. vetoed it. However, all the other 14 members of the Council, including Germany, voted in favor of the resolution. The report in the Times noted that German vote in favor of condemning Israel was authorized by Chancellor Angela Merkel, who had unswervingly supported Israel since taking office in 2005. She turned on him. The situation in Egypt should not be seen as a reason not to continue the negotiation process. She's talking about the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians. As the report quotes Merkel saying at the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University last month, if we sit and wait, we might face an even more difficult situation. They're going to let Palestinians vote and probably have their own state or something. But again, this is a trend. They're using democracy to pin down and to actually destroy elements of the Zionist Pink Rabbit Bankster community, we'll call them, certainly Zionist elements in front of World War III, as we pick up steam into the big events. And they'll get even bigger. You haven't seen anything yet. But now we've got a deepening rift between Germany and Israel over some vote at the UN where the U.S. stonewalled it. The U.S. will always stonewall any vote that goes against Israel. Until the last minute, maybe. Maybe we'll see something the last minute. Who knows? But what we have is Angela Merkel, and the Jews were going nuts over this. If you read this piece and you read the different talk back, all the Jews talking about Germany's Nazis. There's Nazis going to kill 6 million Jews. Yeah, if you don't give them everything they want, your Nazis are going to kill 6 million Jews. But it's a trend toward using democracy. You know, just like they use democracy to destabilize Europe, certain royalty in Europe, they're now going to use it to, it looks like another group's, it looks like someone's using it to destabilize the Middle East, to say the least. European governments, my favorite news piece in a long time, European governments completely puzzled about the U.S. position on Libya. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's meeting, and this is in FP, Foreign Policy. I'll put this up on my Twitter. This is must reading. This is interesting stuff. This is one of my favorite news pieces in my lifetime. This is a fascinating news piece, and this is something we've been talking about. This is one of the reasons from the beginning I use these little groups, these crazy little pink rabbits. You know, I talk about pink rabbits and banksters and leasters. Leasters mostly linked to royalty. They're all traitors with a big T. They all know the score. They all agreed to genocide us, in my opinion. I think history will bore that out. They all pose as Gentiles. Although you can get George Bush walking up and down the street reciting the Talmud. George Bush Jr. Yeah, you got to think about that for a minute. Then you got the other side of the equation. You got the banksters, widely known, very well known. The Rothschilds are well known. But this piece, European governments completely puzzled about the U.S. position on Libya. Inside the foreign ministers meeting, a loud, contentious debate erupted about whether to move forward with stronger action to halt Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi's campaign against the Libyan rebels and the violence being perpetrated against the civilians. Britain and France argued for immediate action, while Germany and Russia opposed such a move, according to two European diplomats who were briefed on the meeting. Clinton stayed out of the fray, repeating the administration's position that all options were on the table, but not specifically endorsing any particular step. She also did not voice support for stronger action in the near term, such as a no-fly zone or military aid to the rebels, both diplomats said. The way the U.S. acted was to let the Germans and the Russians block everything, which announced for us an alignment with the Germans as far as we are concerned, one of the diplomats, quote-unquote, told the cable. Clinton's unwillingness to commit the United States to a specific position led many in the room to wonder exactly where the administration stood on the situation in Libya. Frankly, we are just completely puzzled, the diplomat said. We are wondering if this is a priority for the United States. On the same day, Clinton had a short meeting with French President Nicolas Sarkozy, in which Sarkozy pressed Clinton to come out more forcefully in favor of action in Libya. She declined Sarkozy's request, according to a government source familiar with the meeting. Sarkozy told Clinton that we need action now, and she responded, there are difficulties. Of course, and you can read the whole thing. This was published on March 16th. Now, since then, common sense dictates we've taken action. But what you have, why didn't they take action then? Why are they letting the German and the Russians in there? Why is this happening? Why didn't they take action when the rebels were weakening Colonel Gaddafi? What's going on here? Why didn't they team up with why didn't Obama and Hillary, in this case Hillary's carrying out the president's stuff and carrying out whoever backed the president. Why didn't they back him early on when you've got really Team Pink Rabbit talking about going after him? What's going on now in the scenario coming into World War III? What I believe, and I'll know it when I see Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, if they fall, I know that there's a permanent split between banksters and elitesters. You know, and that split will be golden, and it'll go deep into the bankster lines. And first up in World War III will be Israel. They won't fare well. What happens after that will tell me everything. I've talked about this I don't know how many times to get my audience ready. But what you see now is who owns Taliban. Yeah, there's many different sets and groups and little cliques within this thing, but there are two major factions, bankster, elitester. And I think there's a historic split going on. Historic split between the Rothschild clique and elements of the royalty that they were in bed with post Holy Roman Empire, and this stuff goes way back. And I'm going to go into that a little more in a minute, but I think this is a split that is coming right out in public, and maybe the British and the French just don't get it or whatever. In my opinion, elements of the elitester have been pulled over the barrel by elements in Germany and Russia. We'll call it Team Prussia. Has pulled them over a barrel and split them off. And that's what we see going on coming into World War III. I'll know it if they use this democracy stuff to take down Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. The neocons backed democracy in Iraq, which is about the craziest thing ever. You know, they went to Iraq for Israel's sake or whatever. They think they actually thought at one time democracy was going to favor Israel in the Middle East. It won't. I don't think they're not so naive now. But there's a lot of different cross currents. There's lots of different misinformation and contrary information coming out. And it's hard to tell, but the trend is there. The trend toward a large, large, large war. Is the military overstretched? Interesting question. The boots on the ground are overstretched. You know, we're not going to be putting any boots on the ground. They're overstretched. I don't think we should be anywhere outside the United States. I don't think we should have troops in Japan. I don't think we should be doing any of this stuff. By the way, the Emperor of Japan had said that it might be time, the Prime Minister of Japan actually had said it might be time for U.S. troops to go home. I actually agree with that. Of course, many believe that's why he got hit with an earthquake, but I don't know. I don't know about that, but I do agree with them on that. We shouldn't have troops all over the place, but that doesn't mean we don't have capabilities. When it comes down to our Air Force and Navy, the U.S. has obscene capabilities, and the U.S. Navy and Air Force are not overstretched. To me, they are, because they're not doing anything that I would be doing, but they're not overstretched. Looking at it from an objective purpose, they could wage an air campaign and have a no-fly zone over all kinds of countries. What Israel would go to is expand the no-fly zone. They don't really care about these other countries. They don't care about Arabs killing each other. They care about a new world order. That's what counts here. So I think Israel will actually try to expand the no-fly zone and expand the chaos in the Middle East. They'll go along with it to a certain extent, but it won't end up being good for them. This is not good, but it's a story about the Germans and the Russia pulling apart. Team Pink Rabbit has been pulled apart. If they didn't plan on pulling, if the leechers didn't plan on screwing them over to begin with. And I'll answer those questions about them in a minute, but we have another interesting news piece, which I've actually talked about before, and this is an update. I talked about interesting case in Western civilization going on in Norway. There's a German submarine, U-864, that goes back to World War II. It's a German National Socialist. It was sunk by a British submarine on February 1945. And they were going to have to encase it with cement or raise it because it was full of liquid mercury. Why was it full of liquid mercury? Well, those are several different podcasts adding up to a podcast to tell you why. It has to do with the Glocka, or you could just say our green goddess, our Godzilla, the white rabbit's Godzilla, she eats mercury. It's as simple as that. But anyways, it comes out exactly how big the cargo was on this U-864. U-864 submarine. This German submarine, the U-Bootwaffe. And it came out exactly how much liquid mercury was in there. There's so much liquid mercury in it that they can't encase it in cement. You know, you're not supposed to raise submarines. If a submarine is on the sea floor, you don't raise the thing. It's an iron coffin. That's where they get the term. But this sucker's full of mercury. It's in Norway, and it's an environmental hazard. It's leaking out. They're testing water for it and whatnot. So I'm looking at this email between the Labour Party parliamentary group in Norway, going back and forth between German historical societies interested in why they're going to raise this. You know, they thought they were going to encase it in cement. That's first what they said. Well, encase it in cement, we don't want to raise an iron coffin. I mean, you can't imagine them raising the USS Arizona, can you? But anyways, they decided they had to raise it for one simple environmental reason. It has 60 metric tons of liquid mercury. 60 metric tons of liquid mercury. And there are several of these U-boats around the world sunk with liquid mercury. All liquid mercury. Godzilla eats it. She feeds off liquid mercury, I guess. Fascinating story, but that's an update. I told you that this is a big event and all these groups were fighting over them because these Norwegian officials were going to raise the U-boat, and then they agreed to encase it in cement as long as it doesn't have over a certain amount of mercury. But this has 60 metric tons of mercury. So much liquid mercury that they have to actually raise it. They have to raise an iron coffin. And it's still a very controversial issue, but I thought I'd update you on that because the report never came out of how much liquid mercury it has. You know, what does it have? A ton? 2 tons? No, 60 metric tons. It's a lot of mercury. Where are they going with all that mercury? Well, probably South America. Who knows? American black projects. I don't know, but it seems like the green goddess sure loves mercury. But there's an update for you. And we're going to move on and we're going to talk about, I'm going to answer a question. Alex Jones is kind of a famous Asian provocateur. He shows his colors and his symbolism and the groups he fronts for. And in my opinion, he fronts for Pink Rabbit Banksters. He is a agent provocateur. His status is to go against the government, go against everything going on, because they've created a big problem for themselves in banking. They've created a big problem for themselves all over the world in banking, actually. And that problem has got a big reaction. You see it in the Middle East. You see it every day in America. And he plays into the reaction. He does a good job of scaring the hell out of people. He does a good job. Some of his information is really good. He's certainly a radio personality unlike no other. He's quite a showman. I saw him on TV dancing around. I think he was on, I don't know, some daytime talk show, and he came storming out there, and you know, he's basically a reaction. He's not the problem, he's the reaction. But his job will be to support the solution that that side presents. And the solution won't necessarily be good for the people in power, it won't look good for them, but it'll seem like some good deal and whatever. I've talked about this before, problem, reaction, solution, and their new world order. But that's what he's positioned to do. And he said some pretty funny things about the Nazis being in control of America and yada, yada, yada. Well, elements of the Germans might have been over backwards, the Pink Rabbit Leasers, I don't know, and split them off from the bankers. We'll know soon enough. But there never had, I was asked a question, is there any country that the National Socialists, because I'm kind of up to date on all the material, and I'm not talking about speculation, I'm talking about government documents, and there's a trend that a group out of Nazi Germany, a group of Germans survived. They survived with their science, they survived with their technology, they made a deal, Operation Paperclip, this is all well known, but they made a lot bigger deals than that, down in South America, and they're still around to this day to some extent. In a few different places. But I was asked if they ever ran a government, because Alex Jones is saying that they ran a government. They were running the United States at one time, or they were still running them. They've never run any government. They've never run it. No one has ever produced any information saying they've run a government. They certainly influenced some governments. They influenced American black projects. They influenced the government of Argentina at one time. The Bolivar Network, the big communication network, was basically a German network. They turned it over to, I think it was Argentine state, and they still ran it after that. So they certainly influenced some governments. But they never ran any governments. There's been no evidence of that. They influenced some governments in the Far East. They still have relationships with them to this day. Japanese underworld, maybe. Some other elements. Even in places like China, where you don't think there are fascist elements, there are. There's a far-right bastion that goes right through Taiwan and North Korea and into China, as well as some elements of South Korea. But there are many groups that have been influenced by them and many groups that they've had relationships with. I've seen documents presented. But they've never ran any governments outside of National Socialist Germany. That's it. There's never been any evidence of that. Anything else, you know, you eventually got to produce some evidence. They certainly aren't running America now. America is the bastion of pink rabbits. Pink rabbit elitesters and pink rabbit banksters. You got the machine going in Anglosphere. And we'll talk about the machine a little bit in the next few minutes. But when it comes to the Nazis, what they ran and what they didn't run, you eventually got to produce evidence. In regards to, ask specifically, what are they talking about where a Muslim Nazi who converted to Islam comes back into Europe? And what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that Nazis flooded Europe with Muslims. I went over that before. That ain't going to wash. What happened toward the end of, well, actually what happened even prior to when Hitler came to power in Mein Kampf and started putting a steel broom to the Jews like he said he was going to do. He got all these telegraphs from all over the Muslim world, and they wanted to read Mein Kampf. And of course, you know, they ended up getting a hold of Mein Kampf, and it still has legs to this day in the Middle East. You know, the Nazis never went to them. They went to the Nazis. And from there, the relationship just went forward. In the Middle East, you had several different elements invite Nazis in after the war, whether it be Otto Scarsese, and I think I pronounced that wrong. It's Otto Skorzeny, Skorzeny, who, of course, you know, they have all these connections into the Middle East after the war, and they went around helping, the Egyptians and helping the Egyptians post 1952, and different relationships with the Muslims. But one thing they did do is they looked at a map, and if you look at a map, you're going to notice that the Middle East and the Mediterranean is right there, and the Mediterranean and North Africa is full of Muslims, and the Jews, we're talking about flooding, making Europe non-European, just like they were talking about doing something similar in America, and they were talking about this well before World War II. Hitler, in a speech in 1942, talks about the Jews are going to try to make Europe non-European, non-white. Obviously, where are those immigrants going to come from? Those immigrants are going to come from North Africa, Middle East, and what are they? They are Muslims. What do? They contacted Hitler. They like the Quran. They like the Mein Kampf that goes hand in hand with the Quran, and so on and so forth. Then, of course, you have the Jews moving into Palestine, which is a big catalyst for the relationship between Jews and Muslims. And that, of course, they just did their homework. There's no evidence that they influenced any immigration policies, period. What they did do, it's quite clear in the evidence, quite clear in the documentation, and I'm talking about government documents, I'm talking about there's a trend that they prepared. They prepared the groundwork. And my enemy's not that hard to figure out. You know, they're going to try to flood the place. They said they're going to do it, and they were going to do it. Hitler, before he fell, talked about it in 1942. This is nothing new. But what they did do is they prepared for it. Right afterwards, they prepared for it, especially when the Muslims came running to buy the buy Mein Kampf and bought into a great deal of Nazi propaganda regarding the Jews. I mean, the Joseph Goebbels couldn't believe the type of propaganda coming out of the Middle East on the Jews right now. It's pretty extraordinary. They didn't. They lit a wick. There's no doubt they lit a wick. But a candle has to have a wick to burn, as I always say. And that candle has burnt pretty bright in the Muslim world. But I think a lot of that has to do with Palestine. A lot of it has to do with the Jews opening up the gates to immigration. They just happen to open it up near a lot of Muslims who hate the Jews. You know, the new brown shirts all have brown skin. They hated us more. The Jewish elites especially hated us more than they loved their own children. And they paid the price for that. So what they're talking about a couple instances, one in specific, where a Nazi who was in a Muslim country, happened to convert to Islam, comes back into Germany and is working or talking with some imam. Well, he had no influence. He didn't have this masterstroke influence over European immigration policy. What you have is the gates opening up. They're only going to come from one direction. And the National Socialists, whether it be Otto Skorzeny at the Fascist International meeting, Internationalist meeting in 1970. Well, you know, they're preparing for it. They're preparing for World War III. They're preparing to make sure the little pink rabbits don't have their New World Order is what they're doing. And they, of course, the Jews kind of did it to themselves. What they are doing, and by putting out this information, the Anti-Defamation League groups and all these groups that are attachés across Europe, after September 11th, had started realizing they were in trouble, so they started putting together this information. This is probably guilt by association type information. And skewed information, in my opinion. It's not the whole picture, because there's really no evidence to do what they assume they're doing, other than preparing. That's what the Nazis did. The Nazis, certain elements in Germany certainly prepared. And what they did is they walked with their hat in hand trying to make deals with different European nationalist groups once they got in trouble. And that's what they have done in many cases. Some of the elements of these European nationalist groups may be wise, other elements won't be. I don't know how to critique it other than that, but what they're doing is basically lying, point blank. They're not telling the whole story. They're not telling it objectively. The National Socialists in Germany only lit candles among them Islam. That's all Mein Kampf can do. For a candle to burn, it has to have a wick. And, you know, they stoned them. It's just point blank. All the stuff the Germans were doing, when you get into Otto Skorzeny and Fascista International and whatever that group is he's running in 1970, he's meeting with the Palestinian Authority, he's meeting with, I think it was Hamas, Hezbollah, all these different Muslim Brotherhood organizations and whatnot, right in Italy there. It's an international terrorist meeting, really. That's what it was labeled in 1970. You know, the Jews didn't really pay attention to that. And they've been taken to school, basically. They don't have their New World Order, and they came hat in hand. And coming hat in hand is a pretty difficult proposition for them because they don't do that. They don't do that unless someone has them by the cojones. Abe Foxy Foxman out the Anti-Defamation League is not going to say, you know what, that little white Christian kid was just defending himself. That's probably not a hate crime. Why don't you cut him a deal? I've never seen that from his type. So if they're coming hat in hand with you with some type of propaganda like that to offer you some deal, it's because they don't have a New World Order and they have to deal with you. You don't have to deal with them. That's why I don't really care about them. You know, if you don't have a New World Order by now, you got problems. Big problems. But anyways, that's the little, Jew rabbits, and that is a Jew rabbit faction. Somewhat pink rabbit banksters, yeah, I think they can go either way on that one, but, you know, my thoughts on them aren't exactly, I think they'll sell out the Jews. That's my opinion. I don't think the rank and file Jews mean all that much to their elites. That's my two cents. But they came in and tried to get deals with certain elements right at the same time they were trying to take over white nationalism in America and whatnot. And they were using a lot of propaganda to do it. Partial truth and innuendo. But they don't come around making deals, when they're in control. No, they dictate to you what's going on. If you don't like it, they stomp you into the ground. They thrash you. Just look at the obvious. If you step up in London and go against them or go against their propaganda, they'll stomp you into the ground. You know, that's how they operate when they're in control. So if they're coming around trying to make deals, it's because they're in trouble. Because Abe Foxy Foxman doesn't make no deals. He runs a game. He doesn't make deals. Not from a position of strength, at least. Yeah, so don't let them run the game. Many times Europeans are just too nice. That's my two cents on that particular situation. I've talked about this extensively in another podcast. They got hit with Islamic immigration because they were too busy focusing on us. They weren't focusing. They were calling us Nazis. All Christians are Nazis. Jesus is an anti-Semite. The New Testament is anti-Semitic. They were concentrating on that. They were concentrating on us being responsible, even in somewhere like America or London. All white Christians are responsible for the Holocaust. They were concentrating on that. They weren't concentrating on the enemy that they opened up the doors to. The National Socialists probably saw it early, and they probably saw it for very obvious reasons when all the Muslim officials were telegraphing them, congratulating them, telling them to kill the Jews, and asking them when they can get a copy of Mein Kampf. It probably occurred to them that there's a candle here that can be with a big long wick that can be lit, and that candle looks to be attached to sticks of dynamite. When it comes to anti-Semitism and taking off in the Muslim world. But I don't know how far it would go if they wouldn't have let them into Europe and they wouldn't have went into Palestine. They did some pretty crazy stuff. Let bunch of Muslims behind the flank into Western civilization and then go into Palestine. It looks pretty stupid in hindsight, doesn't it? But someone saw it early. Someone saw it early, but I think it was pretty obvious, personally. What else can I say about this? I got a question about Pink Rabbit Banksters and Elitesters, about their relationship to each other. When you go into Henry Kissinger is an interesting person because old Bob Whitaker quotes him quite a bit. And Henry Kissinger has said something, it's one of my favorite quotes. In reference to the Jews, Henry Kissinger says, anyone that's been persecuted for 2,000 years is doing something wrong. Now, why would Henry Kissinger, as a Jew, say that? Yeah, it was screamed as anti-Semite, and of course he's part Jewish, or at least all Jewish. I think he's German Jewish. Well, when I break down the pink rabbits, what you think is the Jew rabbits, I go into German Jewry, or Jews that were in Europe post Holy Roman Empire, right after the Holy Roman Empire, during the Roman Empire. I believe they were there for a long time, and I believe it goes back to the Hyksos of Egypt. There's another group with them, in the black nobility, if you will. There's another group of royals. I call the royals, by and large, all Elitesters, because now they're all related to each other. Pink Rabbit Elitesters, and there are several elements in power in America that relate to them as well. But when you go into the Pink Rabbit Elitesters, I believe they're a second group. I call them sometimes Team Akhenaten. That's what they promote. That's what their little runts promote and everything else. Their little Pink Rabbit runts. And I call them that because they run them, not the other way around. Yeah, don't let them kid you. And, you know, George Bush Jr., oh, I'm just a Shabazz goy. Oh, they're telling me what to do. I got to do this. I got to do that. He's walking down the street reciting whole elements of the Talmud. Yeah, they run a game. They run a game and they wage war by deception. What's the relationship between them? Well, what you're asking me is basically, in a Kevin MacDonald piece, I think it was, you were shown all the different ethnic relationships between all the Indo-European nationalities. Irish to Scottish to English to Norwegian to Finn to Slavics. And they're all pretty closely grouped. Even the Italians, they're all real closely grouped around center. Around this center, this little graph, you see all these different European nationalities, just a cluster right near on top of one another. And then over to the far right, you see the Jews. The Jews are like something else. They're just something off the wall. European Jewry is just something over there. And yes, I have seen that. And I've speculated on why they're over there. In other words, they're out of the box. They're at least 2 or 3 inches away from any other European nationality, which are all clustered on top of each other. They're not like us genetically. They're more like themselves than they are like us, whereas many European nationalities are just like each other. It's a very interesting piece. You should have sent me the link to it, by the way. But I remember seeing it, and you're asking me, do I think in a roundabout way, do I think that the Elitesters are a group separate from us as well, like European Jewry, like the Pink Rabbit Banksters, like the Rothschild and Rockefellers? Rothschild and Rockefellers are very inbred too. They're not necessarily inbred with European royalty. Coming out of the Holy Roman Empire, you have certain groups of elites, let's call them kings, queens, so on and so forth. And they have interbred consistently up until just recently, and they never crossed with the Jews. So we have a group that is interbred, we know about, little Jew rabbits. We have their elites, Rockefeller, Rothschild. You have Henry Kissinger, who's a German Jew, made an interesting statement. I'm guessing the German Jews are probably a little bit separate. I call the other group that came in, the Eastern European, the Khazar Chronicles. The Khazars were accidentally, some rabbi took them the Talmud way back when, and that's how they got it, and then they moved into Eastern Europe, go figure. But German Jewry, I believe, were already there. And there is a link between these two groups, and the link is one word, Neanderthal. In my opinion, that's the link between them. What you're asking me is European royalty a separate group? Well, they've interbred separately. They've interbred not with other Europeans. We have Indo-Europeans, you have European Jewry, Eastern European, and I'll split it up between Eastern European and German Jewry. I don't know much difference. One probably more refined than the other. One I know has been with us longer. The other just moved in out of the Caucasus. The Khazar Chronicles, I call it. Into the Russian steppes and all that kind of stuff, and came into Eastern Europe. You have European elites, kings and queens, who have always used European Jewry one way, shape, manner, form. And they've interbred separately, not only from them, but from us, for several hundred years. So much so these groups are very, very interrelated. It's kind of interesting. You're asking me, do I think they could be a separate genetic group than us? Do I think the Leedsters are? My gut feeling is yes. I can't put it into words on how or why. But of course, if you're talking about something, the German researchers that did the genome for the Neanderthal say that there's part of humanity that is up to 20 to 30% Neanderthal still. If something like that could be walking around, then racially I'm ready for anything. But yes, the European elites, the European nobles, the European royalty, the pink rabbit elitesters, when you get into the bushes, and I'll put a family in the spotlight, when you get into the bushes, they come from royal elements that have interbred among themselves post-Holy Roman Empire and only among themselves, certain maternal lines, indefinitely to date. There's a couple exceptions in the 20s. Into British colonialism, you have certain Jewish elements breeding in with certain royal elements. That certainly happened. But that is recent. I'm talking about in the last couple thousand years, that's recent. You also have another interesting phenomenon, whereas European royalty got pretty stupid. Yeah, they're too inbred on some level. But, you know, you got certain elements that aren't picking the nice, good-looking Nordic girl or the nice, good-looking German girl. They're picking a cousin. And that becomes interesting when you do it hundreds upon hundreds of years. But of course, the big changing event was probably Princess Diana. Princess Diana, who of course is dead. I think she's from a different maternal line. That's always been speculated about. But do I think they make up a different relationship to us? I can't really, you know, I don't know the science behind it. They know all about their genealogy. They know exactly all about the human genome. There's all kinds of research going on European royal families. My bet is that they consider themselves separate than us because they've never intermarried with us up until recently. You got Princess Diane, which was from probably real European royalty, real ancient European royalty, and now you have Prince William marrying what looks like to be an average British girl. I think that's an interesting new trend. This is very, very new trend. What's going on with them? I don't know. But even when you get into German royalty, even when you get into some of the fraternities they spawn, you got some interesting things going on, and they all come from Holy Roman Empire. You know, the German royals now descend from a group that owned a monopoly on delivering the mail in the Holy Roman Empire. You make a lot of money if you own the mail. Imagine owning U.S. mail, having that monopoly. But my gut is there's something different. There's a difference between them and the banksters. They got a deal, and this goes back, in my opinion, quite simply, this goes back to Akhenaten and his deal with the Hyksos. But these are two separate elements. I think. They certainly have not interbred. The Rothschilds are not necessarily interbred. Have not been interbreeding for hundreds and hundreds of years with European royalty. European Jewry had not done that. But so there could be a link between them. They could be an ancient Neanderthal link. I don't know. I don't know why they do what they do or what makes them so weird. But by and large, you're dealing with another group in Western civilization that is heavily interbred that does not breed with us. European royalty for hundreds of years are interbreeding among themselves. And the reason it's a big deal is quite simply this. We have a situation where we have chimpanzees, and you have all these different nationalities of chimpanzees. Then you have a group of royals, one segment of royals of the chimpanzee kings and queens. They get up and they start using this hybrid group, Neanderthal chimpanzees, to wage war on all the other royals, all the other royal outgroups. And so from Marie Antoinette to World War I, most of European royalty, with the exception of a handful of houses, fall. They got clobbered. This is just a fact. Marie Antoinette lost her head, and by World War I, there's only one house left standing. And they're sitting in the British Isles right now. Supposedly they were German, but I don't know. I don't know what they are. But they're sitting in the House of Windsor there. And they've changed their name several times, and you go into their history, and you end up at some interesting places. But you're dealing with a group of chimpanzees where kings and queens get up and wage war on the other kings and queens. You know, it's like a group related to one another on an in-group wage war against an out-group. And they're using this group, this little hybrid group, to do so. Very successfully. It culminates in World War I, and, you know, the Tsar of Russia gets cut down and they paint a swastika in blood over his family. All mowed down. That was approved by the King of England. Carried out by the Jews. The Jewish banksters were financing it, and the little Jew rabbits were all over it. Yeah, Bolshevism is Judaism, basically, in my opinion. Talmudism. So you have an interesting case in nature where you have a king chimpanzee waging war on all the other chimpanzees with a little group. But he uses this group, this little group of hybrid rabbits, to take out royalty. For a several hundred year span, for 300 or 400 years, he's taken out European royalty. Always taking out European royalty. The Jacobins who cut the head off Marie Antoinette. This is old European royalty. They're cutting the heads off these people. World War I, the Romanovs. So right now you have one group of royal standing. It doesn't matter whether they're in Germany or Greece, they're all related. They're all related to Her Majesty. It doesn't matter whether it's George Bush. If you want to do a deal in America, you got to sit down with the Bush family. Pootie-Poo didn't sit down with your local rabbi. He didn't sit down with Jewish bankers in New York. He sat down with Bush. Ceremonial, well, it's a little more ceremonial. You know, this woman, Her Majesty owns all of Canada. All of Canada. I don't even have a home. She owns all of Canada. You'd be lucky to get an all-white neighborhood in Canada. And if you do have one, don't advertise it. But this is, it's a pretty interesting situation. Animals, we are social animals. White rabbits, indigenous white rabbits of Europe are very social animals. We tend to joust a lot. We'll wage war against other social animals that look just like us. But when you start talking about someone rising up, annihilating all the other royalties, and then post-World War II trying to kill off, you know, the king of the chimpanzees, killing off all the other royalty, because they're the only ones that benefit from this. Who really benefits from killing the Tsar? Who really benefits from getting Marie Antoinette getting their head cut off? Jewish banksters? Yeah, to some extent, but they got partners. They got partners. They're sitting right in front of our face. Don't let them kid you. There's only one benefit from this. The big benefactor is the person that owns Canada and stuff like that. They're another giant benefactor from killing off all these other royals. And then, of course, post-World War II, you have an interesting thing where the king of the chimpanzees agrees with the little hybrid chimpanzees to kill off the chimpanzees. You know, you're not dealing with a natural situation. So the Jew rabbits, I got an excuse for why they're so, we got an excuse on why the pink rabbits are so backward, elements of them. But you're entering into a very unnatural situation. Chimpanzees, might overthrow another chimpanzee. They might take over territory. They might fight over women, but they do not rise up and try to wipe out all the other chimpanzees. That's what you're dealing with here. Once you understand that someone's trying to wipe our race off the planet. Once you understand that the Bolsheviks did not just walk in to the Bolshevik Revolution without approval of the King of England. It doesn't work that way. Once you understand their fraternal system, the Jews do what the rabbis tell them to do, and the rabbis are controlled by a fraternal system. Once you understand that even in somewhere like the Anti-Defamation League, there was a big anti-Semitic incident in Israel where a bunch of neo-Nazis were in Israel, little Jewish neo-Nazis or Russians in Israel that were neo-Nazis. The Anti-Defamation League in America could not handle it. Do you know why? They're a fraternal organization, and they have a charter, and they can't exceed their charter. Their charter does not apply to Israel, and they can't address it in Israel, even though they would have liked to. there are rules of engagement here, and they don't go over the line, but you have traders. There's traders with a small t, and your neighbor who is egalitarian, utopian, who thinks having a blended humanity would be wonderful. That's trader with a small t. They're a trader. They're just brainwashed. You have traders with a large t. And a trader with a large T is someone that was sitting at the table post-World War II when it was proposed that, yeah, we're going to wipe out the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, and they said, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's wipe them out. You know, most liberals, even the craziest people on earth, aren't really going to dream up something that crazy. It's not dealing with something really natural. We don't naturally come to those conclusions. So you're dealing with the prospect of something unnatural. What I'm telling you, chimpanzees don't make a move on all the other chimpanzees. But this group has used, has played their cards quite well, in my opinion, up until just recently. But I call them Team Akhenaten because everything goes back to Babylon. It goes back to Babylon. It goes back to Egypt. It goes back to Hyksos. It goes back to Akhenaten. And I got more questions than answers. But I would say that they might be a separate group simply because there's only two groups in Europe that have interbred separately to the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. Two other rabbits that look like us. One group has openly showed that they have no loyalty to us and they hate us. And that is Team June Rabbit. They're led by the Pink Rabbit banksters, Rockefeller and Rothschild. They call the shots, in my opinion. That group has a deal with the elitesters. There's another group that has not interbred with us hardly at all. And that is Pink Rabbit elitesters, and they're all related to royalty. And they're all related to a handful of maternal lines that are not ever interbreeding with us and have not in who knows how long. Who knows how long? I'm not necessarily paternal. I'm talking maternal lines. You can have some interesting things come in there, but by and large, they're holding a genetic structure for a reason, and they're separate than the Jews. Yeah, they're not intermarrying with the Jews. German Jewry is not intermarrying with royalty that we know of. In Anglosphere, we've had some interesting instances the last few hundred years of Jews taking the title of Lord and stuff like that. But by and large, those are outlier events. You have families here that have interbred among themselves for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, separate than the Jews, and interbred amongst themselves separate to us. So that can always be a head scratcher. But I have questions. I don't have answers, but I have questions. You don't make moves like that on your own gene pool. The head of the chimpanzees does not try to create a blended animal kingdom in only chimpanzee territory. This is very weird stuff. Very weird stuff. So, you know, I always say there are two types of fools. There's a type of fool that say the Jews are my friends. The Jews aren't my enemy. The Jewish elites are your enemy. Their New World Order is to kill you. Point blank. That's what they say. There's another type that is naive. They think those are their only enemies. They're not. They have an agreement. That agreement is stamped in a symbol, two towers. The reason there's two towers, because there's an agreement between two parties. One party we know a whole lot about. I'm interested in that other one. But like I said, when you have, Henry Kissinger saying that anyone been persecuted for 2,000 years is obviously doing something wrong, you know, obviously he's lowering the boom. He don't care too much about the little Jews. Although he's considered part of German Jewry, he answers to Rothschild, Rockefeller, he's part of that set. He's also very, very flexible. When the neocons got annihilated, and that's what Putin is doing, to answer your question, you got that right. Putin is annihilating a crew out of Russia. He's not really taking the hammer to the Jews, because the average Jew, just being a currency trader making money, or the average Jew rabbit at the local synagogue, we have huge cultural differences with them. Our way of seeing the world is not their way of seeing the world. If you take a look at some of the cartoon pictures, some of the different animations that we're going to be coming up with on my site, or what's there now, and you look at the stuff they do, not one and the same. Our ideal of aesthetics. I'm looking at different scripts that they've written for cartoons, and they're written by Jews, because there's a lot of Jews in Hollywood, if you haven't noticed. It's not material I would come up with. But he's not really concerned about them. What he's concerned with is a particular crew there. And that particular crew is what he's smashing out of there. And that particular crew now is operating in America. They were operating a lot more around Obama than they are now. Because there's big questions about Taliban. They're operating in the United Kingdom. They're operating in France. They're not operating in Germany. That doesn't mean the Jews are not there. But you're getting into fraternal structures. You're getting into a whole nother episode. But it's a fascinating thing to see come forward. But there is two separate groups we know for a fact that have not interbred with indigenous white rabbits of Europe in a long time, to any extent at all. One is the Jews. One is the Jews, and this goes back to Rockefeller and Rothschild, and those two are interbred too. Rothschilds have interbred to cousins and whatnot for a long time as well, haven't they? But there's another group, the Pink Rabbit Leasters, European royalty. And I don't know what more to say about it. I break the group down so it doesn't get confusing as they start going at it, because if this group, if let's say the banksters who have had a tremendous amount of power, Rothschild has gained a tremendous amount of power over the past few hundred years from British colonialism, from the Federal Reserve System, these different private banks. You may see the revenge against that group from certain elements of the royalty that they just have an agreement with. You know, they're certainly not intermarrying to any large extent. They're just not. So there, I have more questions than answers, but it's appropriate to ask questions. You know, our race has a very difficult time. I went over this before. I can give you reports of white rabbits taking care of animals. It doesn't matter what animal it is. And you can't tell the difference between them taking care of animals, adopting animals, and them adopting people. Our race has a problem differentiating between animals and people. They don't have a problem differentiating between white and non-white, by and large. That's why they're still all-white communities. That's why they still choose to live in all-white communities. They don't have that problem. But they do have a problem in differentiating between animals. They want to help all the animals, and they assume all the little non-white rabbits are a bunch of animals to be helped out. It becomes funny. You know, in this podcast, I've done this, and I could do it all day long, read you reports about our race adopting animals and interchange it with them adopting real non-white children. You can't tell the difference. We have problems differentiating. But on the in-group basis, when someone looks like us, we're social animals. We assume that because they look like us, they must be okay, just a little misguided, maybe they can come around. Time and time I hear this from conservatives, and many of them are good people. Oh, Lindsey Graham is just misguided. He's a good Southern boy. He's a good Christian boy. He's just a little misguided on race and whatnot. And you'll hear this. Glenn Beck, Bill, they're just misguided. They're nice Christian boys, nice white man. John McCain, he's a nice white man, just misguided. Bush is wrong on some issues, but George Bush Jr. is a nice white boy. He's a nice white man, a good Christian, and he's a little misguided. Meanwhile, he's walking up down the street, carrying a Talmud, reciting whole elements of the Talmud. That's George Bush. George Bush Jr. You better ask yourself what you know about these people who are heavily inbred for hundreds upon hundreds of years, as separate to us, in breeding amongst themselves, almost identical to the Jews have done. Interesting. Interesting, and grounds for speculation, isn't it? But as this comes into World War III, these are the questions I have. But yes, it is most certainly possible, and I went on enough tangents on this subject enough. There's two groups that I would question. One group I know all about, one group I want to know all about. And that is the links to European royalty and the Bushes and all that kind of stuff like that. And in the next piece, I'm going to talk about genetics. Since we're talking about genetics, I'm going to talk about genetics. I'm going to talk about an interesting creature that most of you know about, but none of you really know from a racial perspective. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, right after we take a brief break. And now a word from our sponsor. Have you ever said to yourself, gee, I would love an undercover lover? Or maybe you said to yourself, gee, I would like to be an undercover lover. We know exactly how you feel. For a limited time only, on WhiteRabbitRadio.net, you can buy an undercover lover. You can be an undercover lover. Yes, for only 25 carats. It is a great investment because all the money goes to fight white rabbit genocide, which is the thing we're about here at WhiteRabbitRadio.net. So if you're looking for an undercover lover, or if you're looking to be an undercover lover, or if you're just looking to have the coolest undercover lover in the history of the undercover lovers, we have just the ticket for you, all at a very, very low price. Yeah, so hop on over there and pull up that merchandise tab. And when you see the undercover lover, you'll go wild at how beautiful it is. And hit that buy button. Support fighting white rabbit genocide in the easiest way possible. Be an undercover lover. Now that we're at the end of the podcast, I'm going to talk about something I never talked about before. I'm going to talk about First Dynasty Egypt and some interesting things going on right now and how this relates to Well, an interesting thing I've been asked about that I've never once talked about, and I don't think any racialist or the vast majority of the world knows very, very little about. But first I'm going to talk about Dr. Zawi Hawass. I'm going to give you a brief update. There was a looting of Egyptian museums, and what was looted were inscribed blocks, tablets, information basically. Ancient information inscribed on blocks, taken from sites in Saqqara and Abu Zir. Saqqara is interesting in ancient Egypt because it goes back to the first dynasty. I've been interested in it ever since I saw on TV, and I've seen this more than one occasion, but even this came up again on Zawi Hawass's Chasing Mummies. You know, he had that reality TV show. And they were digging up, and some young white intern from over in the United States was over there. In the show, there were several of them, actually, from around the world. Most of them were white interns, and this one white girl, I think she was from the Midwest, was helping him dig up an ancient queen from the First Dynasty. And First Dynasty goes back to 3000 BC. And this was at Saqqara. It's an ancient burial site. And so they dug up this queen, and they had her jaw bones and her teeth and everything else. And her teeth were perfect, were totally perfect. And this young white girl, this intern that was still in college, interning with Zawi Hawass, she wanted to be an Egyptologist and archaeologist, whatever, was over there interning, and these girls just start freaking out. How could she have perfect teeth? You know, this is a first dynasty queen or a princess or something, royalty, and she has perfect teeth. And they went on about it, that all of them have perfect teeth. How do they have such perfect teeth? I mean, it looks like they had braces. I'm talking flawless teeth on this lady. This skeleton they dug up, I'm sure it was mummified at one time, but it had decayed where it was just basically a skeleton. However, maybe the tomb was looted or something. I can't really remember, but this happens all the time at places like Saqqara when you get back to 3000 BC. It's an interesting time period. First dynasty of Egypt. I got more questions than answers. But I'm going to talk about something related to genetic purity and genetic perfection. There is a creature on this planet that white rabbits, the indigenous white rabbits of Europe, at one time had as pets, as much as dogs, especially in ancient Egypt. It's a fascinating creature, and I've always been fascinated by it because of Saqqara, because of this perfection that the ancient Egyptians exhibited at one time, whether it be with teeth or otherwise. And one of their pets. And one of these pets, to this day, exhibits genetic perfection. So much so that it doesn't matter where one's born in the world, whether it's in captivity or on the plains of the Serengeti, it is genetically identical. It is almost like pure clones. And it goes back 10,000 years. And that is the cheetah. The cheetah has zero genetic diversity. There is no diversity in a cheetah. It can have different spots. It can have different stripes. But they are basic clones of one another. And it is a fascinating animal. It's also on the endangered species list, and it is controversial on why it's endangered. I think it's kind of common sense. The cheetah's mortality rate is very high. It's 90% of all cubs get killed by lions, leopards, hyenas, wild dogs, or even eagles. And also, their habitat has been infringed upon. They're also non-cat-like in a lot of ways. The ancient Egyptians used to have them as pets, and they used to take them hunting. Literally, they would take them out and let them chase down gazelles. At one time, this would have been several years back, but I've been in a position where I've held baby lions. I'm not a cat person. I've never personally owned a cat. I know, I'm sure I have several listeners that do, but I'm not really a cat person, but I've held baby lions. I've held baby, maybe even baby tigers, ocelots. Ocelots are those little cats in Africa that can jump to the ceiling. You've never seen anything jump like an ocelot. Some of these cats can just jump. And holding those baby lions and stuff like that, they're like little super cats. You know, you would think to yourself, there's no way on this earth I would want to try to raise one of these things, because once they stop being cute, which will be in probably a few months, they're going to start eating everything alive. But cheetahs are something very interesting, because even today in Africa, you'll see a white rabbit that a couple cubs will be stranded, and they'll raise them with dogs, and they seem kind of very dog-like. They're very non-cat-like in a lot of ways. And that's just an observation I've had of having them at the zoo. Even having them in a cat exhibit, it creates a lot of problems because they usually put the cheetah in its own exhibit in a big cat exhibit near the lions. Well, they don't breed near lions. They don't like being near lions because they lose 90% of their cubs to them. So a lot of times in captivity, most of the time, they have to artificially inseminate them. It's kind of like me putting a white rabbit family in the middle of Detroit and then wonder why they don't want to have a lot of babies. But they are non-cat-like, and I've always been fascinated by this because at one time in our existence, we kept them like pets, just like dogs. They've never been domesticated because domesticated means bred under human control. There was never any reason for that because they are already genetically perfect. There is no diversity there. What they're saying, I will put up an article about this that is actually pretty unbiased because it talks about the arguments in the field saying, well, the reason the lack of genetic diversity means that unlike other species, the cheetahs aren't able to cope well with environmental changing and are highly susceptible to epidemics and that there's not enough genetic diversity for them to survive. And then there's another argument in this piece saying, the theory that the lack of genetic diversity, I'll read it to you, is detrimental to the survival of the cheetah. Some argue that considering the cheetahs have survived for thousands of years without too much trouble, perhaps the species is meant to be genetically similar. The real survival problems faced by cheetahs, they say, are more human created, less loss of habitat and loss of prey, and they believe that the reason cheetahs do not breed well in zoos can be explained by the fact they are usually placed in big cat sections near the natural arch enemies, the lions, which will put anyone's mind off sex. I think there's a logical explanation for that. And a logical reason for these things. And I think there are a lot of species that are under threat from loss of habitats because humans, obviously, when you get these non-white rabbit populations growing in Africa and everywhere else, well, they tend to threaten everything. Look at Brazil. Look at the mixed populations of Brazil and how they're just destroying the habitats. But that's another story for another day. I think that the cheetah is, by and large, an interesting species because there is no diversity there. They are perfection. And it's a story about ancient Egypt, and the story goes in one direction. Ancient paleo-ancient civilizations, and I'm talking ancient, going back tens of thousands of years, if not hundreds of thousands, some say, and the remnants of a particular type of knowledge, and that knowledge is on genetics. Fascinating type of stuff. We went into that type of stuff on this podcast, but I've never talked about the cheetah. One of the most fascinating mutations in the cheetah that even an emperor, they were taken as far as India. They were used as little hunting pets as India, just like little dogs, just like dogs. This even made Wikipedia. One of the late Indian emperors of the Mughal Empire, I think it was like 1600 or 1500, had saw something for the first time in his life that he had heard about, and that is something that we used to have at one time on this planet. And that is white cheetahs with blue spots. Fascinating stuff, isn't it? That is a mutation. The albino cheetahs, and they're not totally albino, but they are white with gray-blue spots. They're pretty wild-looking. And I'm going to put up the Wikipedia, and this is an animal I want every racialist to look at and think about as we've talked about paleo-ancient civilizations and what the Egyptians were remnants of, what they had knowledge of. Think about what I've said on Saqqara and the ancient queens having perfect teeth. Take a look at this animal. Take a look at the picture of the white rabbit walking with his cheetah from 1700 BC. Take a look at it. It's on the Wikipedia. Then I want you to scroll down to something from 1887 by Fernand Knopf. I think I'm spelling that correctly. K-H-N-O-P-F-F. I want you to look at these two photos. One with the ancient Egyptian walking with his cheetah. Check out the ancient Egyptian's hairdo. Walking with his buddy the cheetah. Walking with his pet. And I want you to scroll down and I want you to look at the picture from 1887. And then I want you to think about what we talked about in regards to genetics. It's a pretty interesting story. The last picture you're going to see on the Wikipedia, and I want everyone to do this. I want you to see both these pictures and think about what we just talked about and think about what we've been talking about on this podcast from time to time about genetics. And look at the last picture. It's called the Sphinx. Take a look at it and take a look at the picture. Just look at the picture. Picture's worth 10,000 words, but it's a story of genetic diversity or lack thereof. There's no diversity in this animal, and this goes back roughly to 10,000 BC. There's no diversity in this animal. It doesn't seem to hurt it too much unless it's, you know, there's too many lions in the area or something like that. But, you know, they lose 90% of their cubs, even things like eagles. Obviously, they're pretty, obviously, they have a lot of competition, in the food chain, but it's a fascinating animal. It's an animal that we used to know very, very well. Just take a picture, take a look at the picture of the Egyptian. And it's a must-see for any racialist. This is must-know stuff that in this podcast, you know, this podcast went on for probably, I guess we have 70-some podcasts up here with the Truck Roy interviews and everything like that. But I really only scratched the surface into this stuff. I've really only sent you down directions because really there's only a few days worth of material. What's, you know, every day's 24 hours, 3 days, 72 hours. I probably have just over that in material, maybe 4 days. But that's not a whole lot of material when it comes down to the history of the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And our history is one big mystery, and we're going to be finding out a whole lot more about that. So that's an interesting story about Egyptian lootings. I'm interested in who took them. I have a feeling it's not who we think. It's not the little Jew rabbits, because when you get into First Dynasty and you get into Saqqara, you get into interesting information. When you get into the genetic perfection and what some of these ancient queens must have looked like, their teeth, everything was just perfect. And then you get into another interesting story, the story of the cheetah, which was, you know, at one time white rabbits raised them like doggies, and I can see that. I can't see raising any other cat like a doggie, but they seem very, very dog-like to me for some reason, and I'm a dog person. So, interesting story. Things that make you go, but check out that Wikipedia piece. It's all on my Twitter. Check out the article about genetic diversity. I'll even post something on Saqqara. I'll even post something on Egyptian lootings from the status of Egyptian antiquities today, from March 3rd. It's a must see, and there are plenty of head scratchers there. This has been another episode of Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit, and as always, thanks for listening. We are now at the end of another episode of Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. And this podcast is, of course, all as always, dedicated to practical politics. But I'd like to take this time to thank you for tuning in to another episode. On behalf of the Indigenous White Rabbits of Europe, it is yours truly, Horus the Avenger. And I'll be back with you in another episode in the near future. Until then, thank you for listening.